Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith. We hear from Rolive Solholm, chief editor at the Norway Post, and international law expert Francis A. Boyle. They join us to talk about prospects for peace in Palestine and assess the significance of President Barack Obama's Nobel Peace Prize, the small but symbolic Norwegian military presence in Afghanistan, is discussed from a Norwegian journalist's perspective and from the perspective of an international legal expert with experience in the Balkans and the Middle East.
Holbrook has basically set off a civil war over in Pakistan. Right now, I think Netanyahu and his security services over there are regretfully, it appears, coming very close to provoking a third intifada.
First, Professor Francis A. Boyle. He served as counsel to the Provisional Government of the State of Palestine and is counsel to Bosnia and Herzegovina and attorney of record for the Chechen Republic of Ichkeria and has represented national and international bodies, including the Blackfoot Nation of Canada, the Nation of Hawaii, and the Lakota Nation, as well as numerous individual death penalty and human rights cases. Professor Boyle's 11th book is Breaking All the Rules, Palestine, Iraq, Iran, and the Case for Impeachment. He combines scholarly work on the law with legal representation for nations and peoples and work with human rights groups like Amnesty International, as well as peace groups like the American Friends Service Committee. He drafted the Biological Weapons Anti-Terrorism Act of 1989, signed into law by President George W. Bush. And from 1991 to 1992, he served as legal advisor to the Palestinian delegation to the Middle East peace negotiations. Professor Francis A. Boyle, welcome again to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you for having me on, Dori, and my best to your listening audience.
Should we start by saying where were you when you first learned that Barack Obama won the Nobel Peace Prize, and what was your initial reaction?
Well, I woke up this morning. I had clicked on my laptop to find Obama and just thought it was truly Orwellian that they would give him a Nobel Peace Prize, given the fact that he's waging wars against Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Somalia, threatening war against Iran, and starving to death 1.5 million Palestinians in Gaza. So it's a bummer, as people my generation say.
Given that it's a bummer, it comes with, I think it's $1.4 million as a cash prize. That could help a lot of Palestinians.
Well, Obama says he's giving it to charity. I guess we'll have to see what type of charity he gives it to. I really don't know. But you have to understand how highly politicized the Nobel process is. First of all, Norway is a NATO ally of the United States government. And the people who decide to give this award are all retired Norwegian politicians, usually pretty conservative people. And in addition, right now as we speak today, Norway has several hundred troops over there in Afghanistan. So this is really a way to legitimize, as it were, what Obama is doing around the world, not just in Afghanistan. Indeed, I think it was ironic that the award gets announced and then Obama gets up, and then he goes back for yet another meeting of his war cabinet, his war council, which has been meeting all week long on how to better wage war against Afghanistan and Pakistan. So again, it really gets back to George Orwell's 1984, you know, war is peace, freedom is slavery, ignorance is strength. We all love Big Brother, and I guess Obama too.
Well, the president has lost some stature with human rights activists after applying what many have called a double standard. Obama supporting the ICC indictment, International Criminal Court indictment of Sudan's Bashir on crimes in Darfur, but then not supporting Judge Richard Goldstone's report on Gaza and his calls to bring Israel to the International Criminal Court as well, if the Netanyahu government continues to stonewall on investigations. So then what will the Obama White House do under these critical circumstances of life and death? that people in the human rights world have been working on for decades and really often under great pressure from Israel. I know Human Rights Watch has been complaining. There's a story in The Nation magazine about that.
Boy, Dory, that's quite a question. Let me respond ad seriatim. It is interesting that having made Nobel Peace Prize nominations myself, qualified as a professor of international law, that the deadline for the nomination is February 1. So apparently someone nominated Obama last February 1, shortly after he had been installed as president and hadn't accomplished anything at all, except de facto signing off on the Israeli obliteration of Gaza, where 1,400 Palestinians were just blown away, courtesy of United States military weapons, equipment, and supplies. Then Obama comes into power and surrounds himself with hawks, militarists, and warmongers left over from Bill Clinton's administration, and also many from the outgoing Bush administration. The truth is, there is just one dove in this entire administration, and that's Senator George Mitchell. All the rest of them are not doves. They're all hawks. And Senator Mitchell was put in charge of the Middle East peace process. But as we just saw in New York, Obama capitulated to Netanyahu on the settlement. And I regret to say, even though I was giving Senator Mitchell the benefit of the doubt because of his work there in Northern Ireland, I think the Middle East peace negotiations are now dead in the water. I don't really see anything Senator Mitchell can do to revive them, because it's clear Obama is not going to give him any support. As for the Israeli attacks on Human Rights Watch, I mean, what can I say? I'm not here to sing their praises one way or the other. You know, there's Soros money behind Human Rights Watch. But, you know, Ken Roth is a decent guy. He's the director there. They do a much better job on the Middle East, I think, balanced certainly, than Amnesty International, which historically has been very pro-Israel. I was on the Amnesty board for 4 years. But, you know, that's typical Israeli Hasbara. You know, you smear anyone that, you know, is critical of you in the hopes that some of it will stick. We see remarkable and unfortunate continuity between the Bush policies and the Obama policies, both internationally and domestically. I had hoped in my last book I'd expressed an opinion, perhaps it was with an interview with you, that at least when it came to the police state tactics pursued and erected by the Bush administration, that as a teacher of constitutional law, Obama would do something to reverse them. And unfortunately, he has done absolutely nothing to reverse any of them. He has simply continued to support them all. And not only rhetorically and in Congress, for example, this latest renewal of the USA Patriot Act, which is the blueprint for the U.S. police state, but also in court, in federal courts all across the country. Obama appointed the former dean of Harvard Law School, Kagan, as Solicitor General. She's a neoconservative, fully supported the Bush war on terrorism, which is completely bogus, and has ratified and supported in federal courts at the district court, appellate court, and Supreme Court level, the Obama positions across the board. As for foreign affairs, defense, counterterrorism, no real change to speak of. Gates is still at the Department of Defense and all his people. At the CIA and the National Intelligence Czar, Obama kept everyone but Panetta and put Panetta in there, I guess, as you know, a showpiece, but Panetta hasn't changed any of the policy. National Security Agency, everything continues. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Obama continues the Bush appointee. As for the war against Afghanistan, he picks McChrystal, who was in charge of U.S. Special Operations Command that was basically running a death squad. So what we've seen, I think, is continuity across the board. With Obama, he has better PR people, better PR. He gives better speeches, but he's sort of Bush light.
Well, just to review, the White House backing off on their call for a settlement freeze, the Israeli government then taking that as a green light for more militant policies. Netanyahu and his foreign minister, Avigdor Lieberman, then pressuring the Palestinian Authority either drop their endorsement from Judge Goldstone on Israeli war crimes, or Israel would not attend peace talks. Then Israel threatening a contract that would have benefited a Palestinian company unless Goldstone were dropped. And of course, ultimately, the Palestinian Authority caved in, but then came under pressure from within by very unhappy Palestinians who saw them siding with Israel. So finally, the Israelis now saying they will not attend peace talks, and it seems the whole thing has just unraveled.
Well, that's correct. And actually, the Obama administration is continuing the Bush policy of enforcing a stranglehold on Gaza. U.S. general is over there now working with the Egyptian authorities to prevent the tunneling under the desert from Egypt into Gaza, where vital supplies are flown in, and apparently giving Israel intelligence to destroy the tunnels. As we speak, Israel just cut off all access to Gaza. It appears from the events since Yom Kippur that Netanyahu is at Al-Aqsa Mosque pursuing a deliberate strategy to ignite a third intifada, which is exactly what Ariel Sharon did on the second intifada. It was a deliberate provocation there by Ariel Sharon, September 28, 2000, at Al-Aqsa Mosque. And it appears Netanyahu is doing the same thing. And the reason is he's simply not interested in peace. He's interested in keeping the West Bank. And indeed, Netanyahu has recently stated he's not interested in leaving the Golan Heights either, and wants to hold on to that, despite the fact that Prime Minister Rabin, the former general, had concluded a peace treaty with Syria for full peace, for full withdrawal. And then, of course, as you know, he was murdered over in Israel by a right-winger who didn't want peace. As for the Palestinians, well, you know, as I said before, I was legal advisor to the Palestinian delegation to the Middle East peace negotiations from 1991 to 1993, at the time Oslo was signed. And, you know, based on my involvement in the process, Israel's objective has always been to offer the Palestinians nothing more than a Bantustan or an Indian reservation, at best, if they're lucky. And nothing has really changed, certainly, since they tendered that offer in Washington in 1992. Whether it's Labor or Likud or Sharon. And now it appears that under Lieberman, they're not even willing to give the Palestinians a Bantustan. Leads to my conclusion that without any support from Obama, Senator Mitchell is pretty much wasting his time. I've called it a dog and pony show. You know, at a circus in between the big acts, they bring out the dog and pony show to distract attention while the workers dismantle the one big act and then set up the next big act. The situation could get far worse if Netanyahu does succeed in setting off a third intifada. It will be far more violent than the second intifada, both for the Palestinians and the Israelis.
What about regional talks and Syria?
There was eventually, by Prime Minister Rabin, good faith negotiations with Syria. There, I think, because Rabin, the former general, concluded that, you know, Syria could do some serious damage to Israel militarily with their rockets. And if he were to conclude a peace with Syria, he could pretty much do whatever he wanted to do to the Palestinians. So there was a comprehensive peace settlement drafted, ready to go, and Rabin was murdered. But with respect to the Palestinians, certainly from my involvement, direct involvement in the process, and 1991, there's never been good faith on the part of the Israeli government, whether Labor, Likud, Kadima, call it what you want. The bottom line is, they want the West Bank for themselves, and they want all of Jerusalem for themselves. And looking for an opportunity, should it present themselves, for another round of ethnic cleansing, expelling large numbers of them into Jordan, because the Israeli government, whether Labor or Likud, has always taken the position that Jordan is Palestine, and that's where they should all go. It is very unfortunate, because while I was at the peace negotiations, I was also advising the Syrians during the first round, and certainly the Palestinians and the Syrians did go there in good faith to negotiate. Perhaps Obama is going to revive the Syrian track. That would be a good thing to do. You know, he's at least said he's going to send an ambassador over there. He has two emissaries dealing with Syria. Of course, they're both Israel lobby people. But, you know, if Netanyahu is prepared to come off the Golan Heights, there could be peace with Syria. But I don't really think Israel has the least bit of intention to give the Palestinians the basic minimum requirements that they would need for peace.
You know, initially there was enthusiasm about the Goldstone report, human rights organizations saying it confirmed what they had already reported, but does it have any strength to be used as a tool for, you know, pressuring for peace?
Yes, well, we know for a fact that the Obama administration instructed its U.N. Ambassador Rice to torpedo the Goldstone report at the U.N. Mike Posner, whom I had worked with before, I had great respect for, as a human rights lawyer, is now the Assistant Secretary for Human Rights. And what happens up at the U.N. Human Rights Council, Obama instructs him to basically undercut the Goldstone report. I think we have to be careful here in thinking, you know, that Obama is a good guy and it's all the people around him. You know, it's like the good czar theory back before the Russian Revolution. Well, the czar is a good man. It's all his advisors. Now, John Pilger reported that after his graduation from Columbia, Obama went to work for a CIA front organization for 1 year. So I think we really have to ask ourselves, you know, who is Obama? Who has been behind his career and his remarkable ascent from when he was nothing more than a state senator over here in Illinois to senator of Illinois and then running for the president and winning the president? Who's really behind this guy? Who's really pulling the strings here? I don't know, but John Pilger, as you know, is a recognized investigative journalist, and he's written about this. I think people have to be much more skeptical about Obama. I think we have to look at what he's doing, and what he's doing is he came into power and immediately launched Predator drone strikes there in Pakistan and said he was going to escalate that, despite the fact that during the campaign, his opponent, Senator McCain, and no softy there, criticized that strategy. And since Obama's come to power, taking Richard Holbrooke, who is an out-and-out hawk and war criminal, putting him in charge of what they then called the AFPAC theater of war, Holbrooke has basically set off a civil war over in Pakistan that has created a humanitarian catastrophe for millions of Pakistanis. So things don't look good at all. Meanwhile, you know, there's been a small reduction in U.S. forces in Iraq. We continue to wage war in Somalia. And the Obama people are still threatening Iran. Now, in fairness to Obama, he did live up to his pledge to open negotiations with Iran. And the one day of negotiations did seem, according to the public published accounts in the Western news media, did seem to be productive. But you can tell then the forces doing the best they can in the Obama administration, in the news media, the punditry, to sabotage those those negotiations. So, you know, I do think we have to give Obama credit there on opening those negotiations with Iran. As for the cancellation of the U.S. ABM system in the Czech and Republican Poland, well, look, if you read the fine print, basically we're instead of deploying strategic ABM, we're deploying theater ABM more quickly and more effectively that will have the capability for strategic ABM no later than what the Bush deadline was. So that, I think, was a lot of smoke and mirrors. Obama did indicate, at least by making that decision, he has made possible a renewal of the START treaty with Russia, which is very important. It comes up, it expires in December. Certainly we need a renewal. If the strategic ABMs had stayed, I doubt it would have happened. But I think we gave Russia the minimum amount needed to go forward with a renewal of START. But those, you know, to my knowledge, and, you know, you can read it as best as I can, those are the only developments he has to his credit. And if you read the will of Alfred Nobel and the statutes, which I have incidental to making my own nominations, you know, it's supposed to be for someone out there promoting peace and working for nuclear disarmament and things of this nature. Well, here we have a guy who's attending war council meetings and bombing Afghanistan and Pakistan. So, again, I think we have to look at the politics of this, that, you know, the notion that Norway is over there and they're a bunch of Scandinavian socialists and softies is ridiculous. They're part of the NATO alliance. They fully back the United States government. We have always used them as cat's paws to pursue goals indirectly that we were pursuing ourselves. For example, the Oslo Accords. It's clear from the record that we used them to impose a Bantustan on the Palestinians, and they went along with it. So, you know, I think one has to look at this from a political perspective. They're anointing Obama, giving him legitimacy to continue to pursue these policies that otherwise he certainly would not have had. On the other hand, I mean, this is a blip on the screen that will probably last between now and December 10 when he accepts his award, and, you know, the anti-war movement here in the United States will have to carry on and try to stop and wind down these wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, prevent a war in Iran, Somalia, and elsewhere. Just last week, Obama sent 3,000 Marines into the Philippines equipped for combat, with no authorization from Congress, in violation of the War Powers Resolution, to go off there in the jungles and fight Abu Sayyaf, and basically to reverse the decision made by the former President Aquino and the Parliament to boot the United States out of the Philippines. So that is being reversed as well as we speak.
We'll return to our conversation with Professor Francis A. Boyle in a moment, but we want to turn to a phone call with Roleiv Solholm, the chief editor at the Norway Post. And we had just learned about the Obama Peace Prize. The Norway Post is an online newspaper. He reports on everything from sports to politics. And one of his print stories notes the calls for more NATO troops for Afghanistan from Secretary General Dane Anders Fogh Rasmussen. The Secretary General posts regular videos on his website, and here he is speaking with young people.
We are stepping up our efforts to train the Afghan National Army and the Afghan Police Force. In the end, a peaceful Afghanistan must be built by the Afghans themselves. It is my hope that during my tenure as NATO Secretary General, the Afghans will take over lead responsibility in most parts of the country. But I want to emphasize, NATO will stay as long as it takes to finish the job.
We asked Rolive Solholm to comment on this as well as the Obama Peace Prize.
As far as the Peace Prize being awarded to President Obama, I think that caught a lot of people by surprise. But when sort of things had settled and the Nobel Peace Prize Committee had explained their reason, I think that was accepted by people as, you can say, support of Obama's visions for the future, if you could put it that way.
And I think a lot of people have been wondering if the visions will ever be manifested by actions.
The Nobel Peace Prize Committee, I think that was their reason, that they wanted to give support to Obama's visions to ensure that it would in fact become a reality. They said that in so many words.
There was a challenge, I think, from one politician, Erling Folkvord, who suggested that, let me just quote your piece, "Norway has unfortunately joined in the same type of big power warfare, which has ravaged and destroyed Afghanistan for 30 years, and that Norway must get out of this."
I think he is a fairly lone voice in saying that. There is, of course, a coalition government in Norway now, and of the three coalition parties, there is the Socialist Left Party, which is, they are against Norwegian troops in Afghanistan per se, but as a part of a coalition government, they have accepted the fact, and Norway does have a part to play in as much as we are a member of NATO, and NATO is also in there as a force, together with the United States, and the Norwegian view is that, of course, we should put more effort into, you can say, the civilian part of things, in training the police, in training also the Afghan army and Norwegian support personnel are, in fact, on missions with the Afghan army as part of a training program. In that sense, I think we are in Afghanistan, yes, but also with the aim to build the Afghan society to be able to fend for themselves, in other words.
Well, U.S. forces appear to be struggling with that very kind of mission. And, you know, some are getting killed. It just doesn't seem to be going well in general there. A lot of discussion about, you know, can this succeed? But it reminds me, too, of the Balkans operations when things were very touch and go and there were many factions to be dealt with and it just never seemed to get better for a very long time. Of course, now we're seeing violence on a regular basis and I think some in the last few days.
Yeah, definitely. In peace missions, you are often caught, you know, between the two sides, and it is difficult when you are supposed to be in there as a mediator, and Norway, of course, is active in various, has been more active in various peace missions, so we are very familiar with that.
We're speaking with Rolive Solholm. Can you tell our listeners here in the U.S. about the newspaper that you edit?
Well, this is a small web channel, you can say, of English news from Norway and about Norway. Some of us have felt that there are too little efforts being made in telling the world what was going on in this little strange country up under the polar ice, you know. So we are trying to mirror what's going on over here and putting in the context of the rest of the world.
I noticed that you've also been writing a little bit about the oil and gas industry and a company, I think it's DNO, restarting operations in Iraq. How big is DNO? I guess the stock exchange rose some 35 or 36%.
That you know, it's another side of what we were just talking about. The DNO is in Iraq and working to help the Kurdish minority up north in getting at some of their natural resources to help them build their society. And this has, you know, hit some difficulties because in the process, some stocks were apparently sold in a way that could lead to somebody assuming that it was greasing some hands, which it wasn't, as it turned out, but it was enough to cause a conflict, which closed down the DNO operations there for a few days until things were cleared up.
Can you say how long DNO has been in Iraq?
No, I can't tell you offhand. I would assume that it is about a couple of years that they have been in there and been helping out. Of course, it's a business proposition, but at the same time, it's part of a way to help the Kurds to utilize their natural resources.
Right. I know the Coalition Provisional Authority in Baghdad, inside the Green Zone there, was working diligently to try and draft new laws on the oil industry. That became a very major sticking point on whether or not U.S. troops would stay. And then, you know, the U.S. built these big bases. Is there a broad involvement of Norwegian companies in the Middle East in general?
There is some, but I wouldn't say there is a major involvement. I think DNO is sort of a unique case in the sense that they are in Iraq, but on the Kurdish sort of independence side, you know. The result of the conflict is that, yes, they are back in operation, but no, they cannot export their oil. So in a sense, there is still a conflict. So we'll have to wait and see what happens.
So maybe some of the people buying stock are doing so to strengthen their case?
Yeah, but at the same time, of course, they're able to sell the oil inside the Kurdish area. So you can say that as long as they're operating, they're also making money. And of course, in the future, who knows, it may be a business proposition that can certainly be attractive.
Finally, what about the Norwegian news as the information came out that it would be Barack Obama? What's been the response, and what can you tell us about the way people view Barack Obama's presence on the world stage in general? I mean, is there the kind of belief system that includes his vision that he's talked about, you know, the escalation of U.S. troops and others in Afghanistan and sort of still using force in places like Pakistan?
I can start at the other end. I think the day or the evening here, evening or night, that Obama was elected president of the United States, I think it was received with applause here in Norway and in Europe in general. I think what you in America don't realize is how popular President Obama has become in such a short time. I think people saw him as an instrument of change of American policy. I think, sad to say, that America had become sort of not the friend of Europe that it used to be, and that has completely changed with the election of President Obama. He, I think, has put America into the forefront here in Europe, and I think in many other parts of the world, and become very popular. I think people admire his outspokenness. He talks about things in a way that most of us understand, and we like to hear him say it, and we like to see that he succeeds in the many visions that he has for not only America, but the world as a whole. And I think, you know, if you quote some of the things that the Nobel Peace Prize Committee said, the vision of a world free from nuclear arms has powerfully stimulated disarmament and arms control negotiations. Thanks to Obama's initiative, the U.S. is now playing a more constructive role in meeting the great climatic challenges the world is confronting. Democracy and human rights are to be strengthened. This is the way the committee put it when they announced the prize this morning. And I can tell you one more thing. When there was a crowd of news people down there, as you would appreciate, at the Nobel Institute. And when the chairman, former Prime Minister Jagland, announced you as president, that he hadn't finished before the whole crowd gasped and applauded, you know, and for a crowd of news people and experts and commentators to applaud and announce, I have never experienced it before.
I just wonder, I mean, it's been met with obviously, you know, lots of mixed sentiments in America because Barack Obama right now is sort of embroiled in this tension surrounding war. And there's a major call up here. I mean, you know, so with some 40,000 more, mostly U.S. troops going, you know, there is that discussion. I mean, I think people have just been so exhausted by these 8 years of war under former President Bush that they thought really it was going to resolve more quickly. And also there, the crisis between Israelis and Palestinians has been getting a lot of discussion here because of the Goldstone report. And you talk about maybe smaller internet news sources, and we like those at Talk Nation Radio, and we seek those out. And I think, you know, there has been a lot of discussion about, let's say, the double standard, where you saw the president talking about even signing on to the International Criminal Court, and then you saw him condemning Bashir, and the ICC indictment was something that he supported and Susan Rice supported. And then all at once, the Goldstone report hits and Barack Obama's against it, you know, and it's and then an Israeli power play ensues. And basically the Palestinian Authority says they won't pursue it. And so it's just been one thing after the next for the last few weeks. Have you been hearing about this?
Oh, yes, I have spend time in Canada and the States and, you know, longer periods. And what surprised me most is, was that Americans did not seem to sort of know what was going on in the rest of the world, if you know what I mean. So I think I appreciate what you're saying, because in your work, you could definitely maybe sift through and bring to light some of the views and opinions of the rest of the world, you know, that could help Americans see that they aren't alone in their conflicts and alone in their doubts and alone in their worries, because we all live in the same world. We're not isolated, you know. We all live on the same ball of dust.
Well, there's a lot to be said for people who do various types of independent reporting, because people need to have a voice, and it seems like the media has become smaller and smaller in the voices that it represents.
Let me quote Jagland, the chairman of the committee again, the former prime minister of Norway. He said, "Only very rarely has a person to the same extent as Obama captured the world's attention and given its people hope for a better future." Just think about those words. Gives you a sort of a glimpse of what Obama has achieved in less than a year, for granted for himself, but also for America. I mean, it's like I said, it's been a change in the appreciation of what America, the U.S. in that sense is. And I mean, I must say, you know, in Norway, we realize that the U.S. is our ally and certainly someone that we look to, and that stems from way back, you know, the Second World War, which I was a little child then, but I still remember. So there you are.
I guess, Roliv Solholm, we're going to be wondering together in the next couple of years whether or not the president can live up to this serious responsibility that the Nobel Prize Committee has awarded him. Any final thoughts on this?
Well, as I said, you know, let me conclude by saying that I think, and I think I'm right in saying that, I think the prize was given to give Obama the support that we can give him to achieve some of the visions he has for the future. And I realize, I heard him speak on the steps of the White House this afternoon, that he did not feel that he deserved this prize for himself, but he accepted it as a support for those many who are fighting for a better world, you know. So I thought those words said something, too, about your president.
There's a lot to be said for hope. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us.
Oh, pleasure.
Rolev Solholm, chief editor at the Norway Post. We're going to return now to Professor Francis A. Boyle for his final thoughts on what Americans and others can do to try to wage peace. This in a climate where discussion is continuing about President Barack Obama's win of the Nobel Peace Prize. Professor Boyle has served as legal counsel to Palestinians at peace negotiations and to other nations and peoples throughout his distinguished legal career as an international law expert. He is author of some 11 books, many of which are used by peace activists challenging U.S. policy or facing court, and also by U.S. soldiers now facing legal problems within the U.S. military after refusing deployment or redeployment to Iraq or Afghanistan. We asked Professor Boyle to talk about a program he helped initiate for divestment from companies doing business with Israel as a way to pressure that country to participate in peace talks and come to a fair agreement with Palestinians.
I launched the Israeli divestment disinvestment campaign along the lines of the divestment disinvestment campaign against the apartheid regime in South Africa. You can argue principles all you want with Israelis or Obama or whatever. It doesn't mean anything. They just send out more lawyers and PR people to lie about it. But when you start hitting them in the pocketbook, then they pay attention. And I think the same is true here. You've got to start hitting people in the pocketbook, and then they might start paying attention.
Congress notoriously closed off when it comes to discussions that are serious, really, about Palestinian rights. How to impact Congress?
I don't think we're yet in a position to start impacting Congress because they've all been bought off by the Israel lobby with large amounts of campaign donations. Money talks in Washington, D.C. Certainly money means a lot more than humanity in Washington. I think everyone of any political party would agree with me on that. I think what we have to do is concentrate on building a grassroots movement, as African Americans did, for civil rights out there among the common, ordinary, everyday, principled American people. That's the way, you know, we came up with the nuclear freeze movement, which resulted in the INF treaty, and also START I, which was by Reagan. That's the way we terminated the Vietnam War. That's the way we terminated Reagan's wars against Nicaragua and El Salvador. You know, we really have to work at the grassroots and mobilize the grassroots and get people involved, and then maybe when there's enough of a grassroots movement, Congress or the executive branch might respond. But not now, when Congress and the executive branch are pretty much lapdogs to the Israel lobby.
And is there time? I mean, we've got another election looming in the background of all of this, and a lot of people expressing now this idea that the right wing, given their stronghold over the American media in some ways, will be able to topple Barack Obama, certainly, and maybe put someone in who's much more militant. Others have talked about whether or not it even matters if Barack Obama agrees with Netanyahu on things like Jerusalem or opposition to the Goldstone Report.
Right. As for time, right now I think Netanyahu and his security services over there are, regretfully, it appears, coming very close to provoking a third intifada, which would be a disaster. I don't know if one could ever see peace if there is an outbreak of a third intifada over there. Again, I just caution you about, you know, Obama being the good czar, that even his national security advisor, General Jones, has publicly stated that he gets instructions every day from Dr. Henry Kissinger. We've discussed this before, the impact of Kissinger and Brzezinski on American foreign policy going back to at least 1968. Either one or the other have been pulling things behind the scenes. And speaking of the money, behind both Kissinger and Brzezinski is David Rockefeller. Brzezinski and Kissinger have been on the Rockefeller family payroll for decades. So, you know, this is not a question of the good Democrats and the bad Republicans.
Can you offer us some success stories about international law, especially as it relates to war crimes? Because we've seen challenges to a series of prime ministers in Israel and to the Israeli Defense Forces about their tactics. Most recently, the last three prime ministers, Ariel Sharon, and then Ehud Olmert in power during the Gaza War, and now with Netanyahu. He has been rejected by Israeli voters in the past for being too militant, too right-wing, now seems to be doing well there politically. How will this ever be brought to challenge using international law, and what are some successes that you can talk about to let us know how that could work?
I did try to get Kissinger up in Canada working with a group of Canadian lawyers when he was up there speaking, but the Canadian government would not move on it. We've also tried repeatedly to get Bush Jr. up there. We'll keep trying. Well, lawyers did get Pinochet. I convinced Carlo Del Ponte, the prosecutor for the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, to indict Milosevic, Slobodan Milosevic, the president of Serbia and Montenegro, for every crime in the ICTY statute book, including genocide, which he did, and he was on trial for all those crimes. And, you know, unfortunately, he died on trial. We didn't get a judgment. But we did survive a motion to dismiss on the grounds that after the close of the prosecution's case, Milosevic had a case to answer on all charges, including genocide. I note at the end of this month, Radovan Karadzic will go on trial before the ICTY for all of his crimes in Bosnia. I'll be monitoring that on behalf of my clients, the mothers of Srebrenica and Podrina, many of the women next of kin of the men and boys who were exterminated there. Just recently, an Israeli government official refused to get off the airplane in London because war crimes charges had been brought against him by a British lawyer. Spain has opened an investigation as well against Israeli. I sued the Israeli General Yaron, who was in charge of the massacre at Sabra and Shatila, representing some of the women who were survivors and next of kin. I lost that lawsuit because the Reagan administration intervened and said he had diplomatic privileges and immunity. But years later, a group of lawyers started over again in Belgium, and I did serve as an advisor to them. They went after Sharon, Yaron, Raphael Eitan, General Eitan, and others. So, sure, it's a tough row to hoe. I think the difference is, though, that now, today, as opposed to when the Vietnam War was going on, you have an entire cadre of international lawyers and human rights lawyers and activists, grassroots activists and human rights organizations and NGOs going after these people. It's been reported publicly that Kissinger consults with his law firm before he travels anywhere. Someone tried to get him in France, and he left the country. There's a judge in Spain right now trying to get Kissinger for what he did in Chile. Unfortunately, Bob McNamara died before we were able to get him. But I don't know. Maybe at some point someone will get a Kissinger. But during the past, certainly 35 years since I studied international human rights and human rights law, it's a global movement with lawyers and NGOs and activists all over the world. There is a network. They do keep track of these people. And occasionally, we do have successes like Pinochet, Milosevic, Karadzic, and hopefully some others.
Do you think there will be division within the world you're discussing right now about Barack Obama's Peace Prize and whether or not to criticize it?
Well, the reports I've seen so far are pretty negative. I haven't seen any great praise except for political leaders who say things for diplomatic reasons. Obviously, it's not as bad as when they gave the Nobel Peace Prize to Henry Kissinger for the genocide he inflicted in Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos. You know, the last several hours here on the computer, the internet, just seeing a lot of criticism.
What other advice do you have for people trying to work through grassroots organizing to change U.S. policy and end these wars?
Certainly we have to organize to prevent the McChrystal escalation in Afghanistan. I think the reason Obama is dragging this out is perhaps he would like to see enormous public opposition out there to further escalation. And I think that's why this is being dragged out. But if we don't respond, he'll roll over and play dead, as he did on just about everything else from these militarists so far. We also have to keep the pressure on for reasonable, good faith negotiations with Iran to resolve the disputes the United States government has with Iran, not only over the nuclear enrichment, but, you know, across the board. And then we have to keep the pressure on to get out of Iraq. I think those are the three most critical issues confronting grassroots peace movement, NGOs, and others here in America today.
I just want to turn to a few clips here. During a recent talk at Wesleyan University in Middletown, Connecticut, two Israeli women, Maya Wind and Netta Mishli, told their stories of refusing mandatory service in the Israeli military due to their opposition to policies in the occupied territories of Palestine. Here, Maya Wind shares a story about a court proceeding and explains their feminist views about the Israeli military.
Feminism, the way I see it, and I think Netta also, is about liberation. Oppressing another people is not a feminist act. And that's, I think, the way we feel about it. So even, you know, if women feel like they're combatants, I don't think that's feminism, because they're oppressing other women also, other Palestinian women. And I also think that women who succeed in the army are not women who succeed as women. They're women who mimic stereotypical male behavior. They don't often get a chance to succeed as women. That's what I would say about the feminism issue. And yeah, and you also mentioned about, you know, sort of how to rectify it, maybe to join, change from within. We hear this a lot from Israelis, you know, if you have a problem with the Israeli army, why don't you go in and change it? And one of the members of our group, when she was being tried by a general the day of her refusal, he said to her, you know, I really wish I didn't have to do this to you, because I don't really believe you have to serve time in jail. I mean, like, I see where you're coming from and, you know, whatever, it's a democracy. But, you know, I kind of don't have a choice. But by the way, you know, I really think that you should join, because you could actually change from within, and good people like you should join the army. So she looked at him and she said, you are a commander. You are a really high general. And you yourself just said that you don't want to send me to prison, and yet you have no choice, because this is the orders and you have to obey them. You have to try me, and you have to judge me, and you have to send me to prison. So how do you expect me, as a female, serving only 2 years, not reaching any sort of seniority in the military, do you actually think I can change something? And I think it's a pretty good point.
Longtime New Haven peace activist Anna Aschenbach responded to the statements of these very young women.
I thought it was incredible. I mean, I know, I realize they must have studied a lot to get all the details straight, but they're so courageous, and they have been shunned by their friends and their some of their families, and they said that that was the worst part of it. Even going to jail wasn't as bad as being shunned by some of their friends and families.
Professor Boyle, it has been amazing to listen to the Israeli refusers, both the men and the women. Just comment on them and how powerful it is that these young people are speaking out like this.
Those people are very important. They get almost no news media attention here in the United States. Years ago, I became a member of an organization called Friends of Yesh Gavul, There Is a Limit, founded by a friend of mine over in Israel, Doran Vilner, V-I-L-N-E-R. And basically, military personnel who at that time refused to serve as a matter of principle in Lebanon. And then later it was expanded to the West Bank and Gaza. Despite that, they have no publicity. Even here among the American Jewish community, they get very little support at all. As a matter of fact, when I was on the board of directors of Amnesty International, I attempted to get Amnesty to set up a mechanism to adopt convicted Yesh Gavul resistors as Amnesty International prisoners of conscience. And they refused. They wouldn't do it because of the power of the Zionist forces and money on Amnesty International. So, yeah, I think whatever you can do for them is, you know, these are very courageous people. They're just like U.S. military resistors, like Lieutenant Ouattara, who that's not been reported at all by the mainstream news media. He was discharged from the military last week. He was the first officer to refuse to serve in Iraq on the grounds that it was a criminal war. of aggression and war crimes are going on, and he refused, as a matter of principle, to have anything at all to do with it. We fought a ferocious battle on his part, fought the Pentagon to a draw, and finally, after 3.5 years, they discharged him. He didn't spend a day in jail. It's a great victory for international law, human rights, the laws of war, U.S. constitutional law, and Aaron Watata, who is no longer a lieutenant in the military. I think we need more media attention, to military resistors here in the United States as well. Fortunately, we were able to successfully defend Watata. But there are others that, we can't get the same results for a variety of reasons. You can read how we defended Watata in my book, Protesting Power, and also our defense of Staff Sergeant Camilo Mejia, who was the first military resistor to Bush Jr.'s war against Iraq, and we got him 8 months, which I guess in theory is better than 5 years. But regretfully, despite a first-rate team of lawyers there to defend him, that was the best we could do. Camilo is now president of Iraq Veterans Against the War, which has also been expanded now to include military resistors against Afghanistan. And that's a very positive development, that finally we're seeing people in the military who have been over to Afghanistan and realize that they've been lied to from day one about U.S. objectives in Afghanistan, and they are coming back and refusing to redeploy or deploy in the first place or speak out. I certainly remember when I was young how important the Vietnam Veterans Against the War were, veterans coming back from Vietnam, like Senator John Kerry at that time, and speaking out and opposing that terrible war with the credibility that they had for serving in it. So, I would say military resistors in Israel, here in the United States, both Iraq and Afghanistan, these are very important people, and they're sort of at the cutting edge of resistance to war. I mean, if you're going to be the spear of the imperial states and the first put into battle, and you see what's really going on, I think you come back, and many people, not all of them, but many come back and say, right, I was there, I saw it, I know what's wrong with it, it's unprincipled, we have to stop it.
People have been really astonished at Maya Wind and Netta Mishley, just the way they tell their stories and how strong they are in their convictions.
That's been the case in Bosnia, in Serbia during the war. You had the Women in Black, Ireland, the peace process there, Marie de Maguire, who won the Nobel Peace Prize and deserved to win it, where, we have Cindy Sheehan here. So women have always played a very important role in the peace movement, so it doesn't surprise me at all. And there are some very courageous women over there. I've known Felicia Langer, the former lawyer, and Leah Samuel, and some others. So I don't know the individuals you're talking about, but, I do know some of the earlier founders of the military resistance movement in Israel.
Professor Francis Boyle, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thanks a lot, Dory, especially for this timely interview.
Professor Francis A. Boyle writes and lectures about the relationship between international law and politics, issues of war and peace. His 11th book is Breaking All the Rules, Palestine, Iraq, Iran, and the Case for Impeachment. He is also author of Protesting Power, War, Resistance, and Law. You've been listening to a Talk Nation radio special. Our regularly scheduled program airs Wednesdays at 5 p.m. at FM 91.7 WHUS in Storrs, Connecticut. And then on other stations, it is syndicated with Pacifica Network. I'm Dory Smith. Thanks for joining us. You can write to us at talknationradio@gmail.com. Our website is talknationradio.org.